Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova Said. I'm a host of New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Steuben Hough, a world-renowned concert pianist and composer. In 2018, Steuben Hough published his debut novel, The Final Retreat, with Sylph Editions. In previous years, he also published articles for newspapers such as The Guardian and The Times, and he also wrote a blog for The Telegraph for 7 years. Steuben Hough is a recipient of the MacArthur Award. In 2018, he became an honorary member of the Royal Philharmonic Society. As a soloist, Steuben Hough has performed with leading orchestras around the world. His recitals appeared on all major stages, including Carnegie Hall, Chicago Symphony Hall, London's Royal Festival Hall. And as a chamber musician, he worked with Stephen Isserles, Michael Collins, Joshua Bell. Steuben Hough is also a member of the faculty at the Juilliard School. Hello, Steuben. Welcome and congratulations on your first novel. This is your first novel that you've been thinking about for a few years.
Yes, I mean, some of the subject matter has been in my mind for as long as I can remember, really. And I've always wanted to write a novel. I love the idea of creating a fantasy world that maybe hints at certain truths that even the facts don't get to. But it was always a matter of time, I suppose, and I just, these ideas were filed away, and I've always jotted ideas down on bits of paper and then more recently on my phone. But then I just decided to start working when I read a biography of William Burroughs, and in the chapter on The Naked Lunch, the writer talked about how Burroughs started writing this novel, and apparently he had a suitcase full of scraps of letters and poems and notes and ideas, and he just decided one day to open this suitcase and put something together of all of these ideas. So I thought, well, that's a very interesting way of writing a novel. It's not sitting at a desk and starting with chapter one. And I thought, well, maybe I can work like this in some way. I can actually construct something by creating notes as I go along, and then finally I'll have enough material to put something together, to piece it together. So as this book is really in the form of a kind of diary, I thought, well, I can write a diary as if I'm this priest, and then maybe something could come out of that. So that's how I started writing it, and over a couple of years, I wrote this diary. And of course, because it was written all within one segment of time, then in a way that the consistency of style and of ideas was much easier to have than perhaps with Burroughs, when these were not meant to be put together in one shape.
So in our conversation, I would like to avoid any details that could somehow reveal the novel for those who haven't read it yet. So at least I will try to do so. So since you already mentioned the structure of the novel, I have some sort of a follow-up question on that. Is there any reference to a music composition in terms of form here? There is a frame for the narrative in your novel. It starts and ends with fragments, and I think that you already mentioned this fragmented nature to some extent. So it starts and ends with fragments which are organized as an email letter. How do media devices shape and modify the novel on the structural and narrative level?
I think there are musical thoughts behind behind a lot of it. And although there's very little music in the novel itself, just a couple of side references. But I think the idea of musical shape, you know, as a musician, I've been dealing with this for my whole life, how a composer constructs a piece, particularly within the 20th century, how form breaks down, and that, I find that very interesting, the whole idea of modernism, whether it's in painting or in literature or music. So in a way, this novel begins with a theme, a rather striking one, I think, a rather shocking theme, which then you think, well, where did that go? It sort of disappears, and then you start another movement of the piece. This does happen sometimes in music. I mean, even in someone like Tchaikovsky, you will have a motive happening at the beginning of the Fourth Symphony that you don't know when that's going to come back, and of course it does return, and then by the end of the piece you understand where it was. And I think that's what you were just referring to, is that this little shocking theme that you hear at the beginning only makes sense on the very last page of the book, and then you kind of realize what's been going on. You do hear the theme once during the book, or actually maybe twice during the book, but apart from that, it's a kind of a sub-theme in a way. And that was one of the maybe the modernist ideas that is behind this book. I mean, this book in a way is influenced by that. It's I thought very much with it. I'm telling a story behind the story, really. Mm-hmm. There's a much bigger story in this book that doesn't get told, but that you know is there, and that's the tension that I was trying to create. And indeed, that last page, the final email, you realize that there is an unexploded bomb here in the hands of the person writing the email that he doesn't realize, and we know is going to happen, but I don't tell you about that. But I think that was part of what I wanted to do, was to make the reader, in a sense, work a little bit harder, the reader allow him or herself to explore that. And also, you realize on the last page that you don't actually know the full story. You don't realize what's happened to the character. I'm trying to say as little as possible about what actually goes on in the book, but there are three different possibilities to what happened to this character in his death. And I don't even myself really know, although I have my own suspicions, as it were.
So the novel includes a number of topics. It's religion, faith, belief, and we should also include love, vocation, memory, solitude, loneliness. And you already mentioned some literary references. And to me, at some level, the novel reminds me of Salinger's Catch in the Rye, and I'll explain why. Although your story is about a middle-aged priest, so it does have some references to Salinger's to me. Readers are provided with insights into Joseph's engagement with his private life, how he becomes a priest, how he perceives himself as a priest. An emphasis is also put on how he was growing up, on the transition from childhood to adolescence. So the novel also grows out of memories that Joseph shares through his diary writing. How does Joseph process his childhood and his growing up while engaging in a self-introspective journey during his retreat? And that's where this novel reminds me of Salinger's Catch in the Rye. And on the other hand, you also incorporate this word a lot, which is fake, I believe, fake. And Salinger has his keyword, phony.
Right. Yes, I think that it is... like many of those self-referencing works of literature, it is an exploration of that. And in that sense, of the passing of time, I feel that even though this book is obviously about religion and sex, I mean, those are the two major topics that are explored on every page, in a way, it's also about the passing of time, about getting old, about becoming weak, about what does it mean to live a useful life. And I think that this is very much what I was trying to create. in a way, although I suppose some of the subject matter is quite explosive or quite shocking, I think what I wanted to get across was in a sense, boredom. What is it to be frustrated and bored with your life, to feel that you haven't achieved anything that's been of any value? And I think this is also symbolized by the room in which he writes all these words, which is a very dreary, boring, colorless kind of space, and claustrophobia. I wanted to create a feeling of claustrophobia with one's own life, with one's surroundings, with one's thoughts. And also the idea that outside of this place where he's on retreat is a wonderfully colorful world, you know, that somehow he's not part of. And in fact, what sex, I think, for him is so exciting because it's a symbol of a world outside his world, which is the daily grind of being a parish priest and dealing with boring problems of boring people, or at least that's how he sees it. You know, most, of course, our problems are not boring to us when we have to deal with them, but, you know, time after time after time of most mothers coming to him for advice, the problems are very similar. You know, the problems of children at school, you know, husbands away at work, all of these sort of normal daily things that we all deal with, and which, in a sense, a priest is the filter for in some ways. And of course, they're coming to this priest hoping for advice and for help, and he's conscious that he has nothing to give because he has more problems himself than any of the parishioners who are asking for his advice.
So Joseph seems to be profoundly lonely. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I think this is very much a novel about loneliness. And he's lonely on every side. He's lonely because he feels alone in his lack of faith, and therefore he's lost the friends and the associates who, in religious life. He's lonely sexually because he has no one who is meaningful to him beyond just sexual release. He's lonely with the prostitutes because he realizes that, you know, all they want is his money. His mother is dead. His father died. So really, yeah, he's completely alone. And I think that's really what, and he's alone in this room. So yeah, that's very much a theme of the book, is loneliness. Yeah.
And would you elaborate a little bit more on his relationships with his mother? Because it looks like at some level he experiences some genuine, probably, and true love in terms of mother's love. However, on the other hand, there is some pressure that comes from his mother. For example, there is some pressure of expectations to the extent that he feels relieved when she dies.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a common thing with overprotective mothers. You know, the sense of this is almost a D.H. Lawrence kind of sons and mothers. Reflection as well. You know, of course you love your mother very much, but in her smothering kind of overbearing love, you feel a resentment and you want to push away from that. And I suppose also his mother represents the purest form that he can see of that kind of old-fashioned Catholicism, the unquestioning faith that, you know, that every single part of your day is surrounded by religion. And now that he no longer believes, or everything has just falling apart, you know, his mother is the ideal that he never lived up to. She wanted very much for him to be a priest, for that kind of extreme Catholic mother, that the dream is to have your son become a priest. And he did, of course, but we never have his talking to his mother later in life. We don't know whether she was aware that he wasn't a good priest, although, of course, he was a good priest in some ways. I think we get a glimpse of that, that in fact he was a very compassionate man. But on the other hand, yeah, there's this incredible claustrophobia again. You have the claustrophobia of the room in which he is, and then the claustrophobia of that relationship which he's remembering as he writes this journal.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So when Joseph meets William, there is some hope first that this relationship will be different. And there is a brief mentioning of a classical music collection, which Joseph notices in William's apartment. However, there is a comment that William's tastes are not very sophisticated. And I have a quote here. It's page 145. Now, William's musical tastes were not sophisticated. Romantic Pianos was the title of this compilation, but it made him more alluring to me, as if his caresses and thrusts came from a sensitive soul. As if he meant it, I suppose, I mean. Classical music looks you in the eye. It also cancels out the age gap in some way. There were around 30 years between William and myself, but nearly 200 years between both of us and the Chopin waltz. So I detect a hint of another romantic failure in this comment again, and it will be superficial and fake. So why classical music in this very episode, and why isn't Joseph blessed with some reciprocal love?
Well, I suppose the main reason is that he's in the closet. You know, that as a priest, he feels that he can't reveal who he is, and of course, mostly a relationship requires being public about it. People do have hidden relationships, but I think he doesn't really know what he wants. I mean, he obviously knows that he has intense sexual energy and needs, but he doesn't want the sort of relationship. I think in another chapter of the book, he talks about not wanting someone to come home and have slippers by the fire and have a nice dinner watching television together or something like that. He knows that he can't do that because he's living in a church house. And I think, of course, all of these relationships, and William more than the rest, are all hopeless. You know, he's looking in the wrong place for love. It's rare, I think, for people to find love in that way from a prostitute, just because the whole reason for the prostitute is to leave you and go on to the next person, because that's how that person is making their living. And he knows that, and I suppose always, you're thinking, well, maybe this will be the one, and perhaps he really finds me attractive, but of course he doesn't at all. It's just another client, set of dollar bills in his pocket. So that's the ultimate tragedy, I suppose. And who knows? I mean, this isn't explored in the book, but the prostitute is also looking for a relationship, looking to be loved, and the prostitute is also conscious, perhaps, that he or she is just being used. It's only liked for the physical side. So it's one of the fascinating things, I think, about paying for sex, is that you have two people, and like all of us, all human beings long for intimacy and for giving ourselves to another, and yet you have two people who, for that brief time, are faking it. They're engaging in the most intimate exchange with another human being that we can possibly have, and yet it doesn't mean what the body is saying it means. The physical joining together is not joined by a psychological, spiritual joining together. And so that's all. It's a shadow behind a lot of the chapters on that particular issue.
So you mentioned that Joseph doesn't really know what he wants. On the other hand, he also seems to be open and honest, at least with himself, through his writing. For example, he talks about his addictions and wounds and dreams and other aspirations. Sometimes we also see him angry and frustrated. So he's quite sincere about those emotions. So he also recognizes the fact that he's a priest with who indulges in sensual pleasures. He carries a tremendous burden of guilt. It sounds to me this way, while he tries, if not to get rid of those indulgences, but at least to minimize those. At some point, he also makes some sort of a contract with himself through words, and his sexual life becomes an entertainment of sexual thoughts. So it looks like he does try to heal himself, but I don't think that that healing really takes place. But just to speculate about that, is there any way to heal Joseph's tormented soul?
It's an interesting point, because I do think what I wanted to have in the book was a sense in this retreat, although it doesn't achieve what a traditional retreat might have wanted to for a Catholic, which is that he decides to be celibate and live a life as a dedicated priest, as a priest is meant to be, according to the books. I do think by the end of the book and of his journal on this retreat, I think you do see that something is beginning to heal, and particularly in that little short story about Judas Iscariot, where he examines, you know, this apostle of Christ, who of all of them would seem to be the most cursed, but in this particular instance, I try to make it so that Judas is the one really faithful disciple, or at least the one who really gets something out of the death of Christ at his own death. And so, you know, you have this theme of suicide throughout the book. I think there are four actually in the book, or at least one of them is possible, and it wasn't suicide, but you have these different, you know, explorations of that idea of suicide as the great despair, when there's no other hope, you take your own life. But I think, therefore, in that last, that late chapter on Judas, you see hope, because it's Judas who is the symbol of despair, is able to step back from that particular event. Although Judas dies, but at this very last moment, there is this reconciliation with Christ and with the idea of ultimate mercy. And then maybe Joseph can also achieve the same thing. And I think you do get a glimpse of that. But of course, he dies before we know whether that might have been possible. But I sort of have hopes for him. I think that his state of mind at the end of the retreat is better than his state of mind at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So the final retreat can also be read in a social and cultural level. Joseph's represents a generation that grew up under the pressure of limitations and restrictions. And at some level, Joseph's story is a story of repression and of resistance against restrictions and limitations. And this revolt, however, can have dire repercussions, since the one who resists and protests is still expected to follow some rules. So here we could probably mention Joseph's colleague, who's also homosexual, but he seems to have found some content.
Yes, well, I think his colleague, of course, was horrified. Mm-hmm. By this discovery, for all sorts of reasons. I mean, not just because of problems where he's living in England, but problems back home where he comes from. That moment, is part of our first theme. This theme that just occurs on the first pages of the book, and that's a recurrence of that theme again. I'm not sure Joseph was so embarrassed by that. I think Joseph was very surprised because of how he met this colleague earlier in his life, because the colleague had only been there for a short time, but he'd come across him, but this was a big shock to him. But I think for the other colleague, it was, was something of absolute horror.
So the final retreat, as we discussed, is a story about Joseph Flynn, who undergoes some deep emotional and psychological confusion that arises out of his devotion to religion and his desire to be happy and content in his private life. which to some extent goes against some traditional and conservative beliefs and principles. So in this sense, the final retreat also opens up a lot of levels for reading. But what is a final retreat for you?
Well, it's, you know, I didn't want to write a book that sort of was laying out my feelings about these issues in any definable way, because I think all of these issues are so complicated, and like with so much morality, it's very hard to be black and white about so many things. I mean, certain things, fair enough, but I think with this whole area, I just wanted to look inside the mind of someone. I don't feel at all a connection with Father Joseph, as if it's me. I am Catholic and I am gay. I'm like roughly the same age as Joseph was in the book, but he's a very, very different personality to me. I'm basically blessed with an optimistic nature, and I don't have the same conflicts with sexuality and religion that he did. And my mother is a totally different character from his mother. I don't come from an Irish kind of background, and I think that what the mother represents is a very particular kind of Catholicism, which you wouldn't find, for instance, in the south of Italy, I don't think. I mean, you'd find different versions of it, but there's very much a sense of this. I can see the mother very clearly. I've seen many examples around the churches of the north of England of precisely this sort of woman, who herself, of course, deserves a book because, you know, she is completely tortured by her own scruples and her own religiosity. She feels that she has to earn the acceptance of God by performing all these rituals of Catholicism, which, you know, Joseph, I think, has got beyond that. But to me, the book is an atmospheric book, really. It's one that I hope at the end of it you have a sense of his claustrophobia, of his despair, but also of his hope, because some of the chapters on theological issues that are dotted around the book, I hope they raise some thoughts about this, whether it's baptism, the idea that baptism doesn't change someone's relationship as a baby with God, that the baby is already accepted in love just because of being created. I think that's a very important point for me. Also, the idea of hell is something that I thought about for a long time and made many notes. I was going to write an even long essay or perhaps a short book about this whole idea of hell, whether it's possible that God could ever allow anyone to go there. And so I talk about that in relationship to Abraham and Isaac, which I think is a relationship between those two ideas that I think is very important. If we believe that it's impossible, really, that God could have wanted Abraham to kill Isaac, therefore this idea that we resist God and say, no, I don't agree with that, is actually what God wants to happen, because then we understand what God is about. So when we say to God, it's impossible that someone is in hell, I don't believe it, he says, yes, that's just the answer I wanted you to give. So there are various points throughout the book where I explore these theological ideas. And I think it's also the jarring nature of the two things. I think you are meant to be shocked as you read the book, as you know, you're reading what could be a sermon, and then suddenly you're in the bedroom of a prostitute. And I very deliberately, although I don't think the book is erotic in any way, I don't describe sexual acts in a way that's meant to be titillating, but it's meant to be shocking. You are meant to flinch as you read this, because it's part of trying to create Joseph's own frustration with himself. And so it's meant to be a razor to the skin at times when I describe those things. And I want the reader also to feel uncomfortable with it, because of that kind of contrast between religion and sexuality.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So you already touched a little bit upon the upon some hope that the end of the novel evokes. And yes, there is some sort of resolution, or there is some sort of, like, at least a hint at some peace. In addition to this sort of closure, there is a lot of open space left. And I was just wondering if there is any possibility for a continuation for this novel.
Well, I did wonder if I could tell. I don't think a continuation, because of course it is the final retreat. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the title suggests that there's an end to this story. But it would be possible, I think, to go in and tell other stories of other characters in the book. I think, in fact, all of the characters could have a novel told from their viewpoint of almost the same events. So that might be interesting. But I do have another novel in mind, but it's going to have a mm-hmm. musical theme. And it won't have anything to do directly with this. Nothing is impossible.
Well, then we're looking forward to your new novel. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on the novel. The Final Retreat offers an insightful story of the priest who undergoes this profound subversion of his religious stability and his emotional balance and sanity. The book raises a number of questions which resonate with the current political, social, and cultural environment, and provides some space for thinking through the current challenges. Thank you so much, Stephen.
My pleasure, Natalia. Lovely to chat.
Today I spoke with Stephen Huff about his novel, The Final Retreat, which was published in 2018 by Self Editions. Thank you for listening to the Literary Studies podcast in the New Books Network.